So let's get this started. So if this is your first time here with us today, welcome back, or welcome, and welcome back if this is not your first time, to Behind the Shield, a monthly gathering of cybersecurity professionals and enthusiasts discussing the industry's hot topics, what's going on out there in the world, the current events. And my name is Marco Estrella, and I'm going to be today's host. This is the fourth installment of Behind the Shield, and we're hoping that it's going to be a lot more to come. We're hoping to have a real open discussion today in a relaxed environment in which you can ask questions to various cybersecurity specialists. We hope to present you with quality content so that we get to see you again in the future episodes of Behind the Shield. We also love hearing from you. Those who've been writing to us in between shows, thank you very much. Keep letting us know after the show what you thought of the show. In our follow-up survey, please feel free to suggest topics for the following episodes. That is really appreciated. Thank you very much for those who did that already. Also, I would like to mention that you can find information on Behind the Shield on our webpage, virtualguardian.com/event. And you can find links to past episodes that have been turned into podcasts. And now, yes, we are a podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Amazon, Alexa, iHeartRadio, and others. The agenda is quite simple. 30 minutes of current events, followed by 15-minute spotlight talk and a 15-minute question and answer period. You can participate by submitting your questions throughout the event in the question and answer section of your Zoom interface. And I'm going to try to get to your questions as the show progresses all along the event. So let's jump into our hot topics where our cybersecurity professionals discuss current events. And let's see who our panelists are today. In the red corner, we have Christos Simotas, Virtual Guardian's Offensive Security Team Leader. Christos has been practicing offensive security for more than a decade and has even managed to be elected to the EC Council Wall of Fame. In the blue corner, one of the co-founders of NaviLogic, we have Bill Strube. NaviLogic, a virtual guardian company, along with their fantastic partners, defend against guys like Christos. And to help keep everybody civil, I've brought in some muscle today. We're happy to welcome back Virtual Guardian CEO Patrick Naum, and as well as today's spotlight speaker, Chris Vincent, who is Senior Vice President of Go-to-Market Strategy at Halcyon. You won't want to miss his spotlight talk called The Truth About Ransomware in about 30 minutes, and that's going to be pretty cool to listen to. Patrick, Chris, welcome. So let's get right into it. Generally, when people talk about cyber attacks, your mind goes to criminal organizations, cyber warfare, maybe nation states stealing secrets, hacktivists, and stuff like that. But sometimes we forget that there's some lone wolves out there, people acting, alone for their own personal gain. So when I read this first story about a teenager, was behind, allegedly behind the Uber hack, I was going to describe him as a script kiddie. And a script kiddie, for those who don't know, is typically a younger person acting alone being a pest, breaking stuff, accidentally, sometimes even accidentally defacing websites or accidentally exploiting networks. However, 2 days ago, just 2 days ago before the show, so I had to amend my script here today. There was some articles that came out, and it's been reported that that same teenager, going by the alias Teapot, believe it or not, working with a hacking group called Lapsus, is also behind the Rockstar Games leak. So for those who don't know Rockstar Games, they're the ones that make Grand Theft Auto, and the gameplay of that super important intellectual property has been leaked allegedly by that same guy. So I'm not calling him a script kiddie anymore. I'm calling him a cyber criminal. Christos, how did 18-year-old Teapot get complete control of a multinational organization like Uber and leak intellectual property from Rockstar Games?
So as you said, Marco, if you've been reading the news, you probably heard Uber was hacked. And what's super interesting is that this wasn't an organized crime group or a nation state or something like this. It was a single teenager, in fact. Now, that's pretty unique. And it typically, we'd have to wait months, up to a year, for a full intrusion report to be written out in order to find out who what happened, who was behind it. But in this case, the hacker was actually spamming their Telegram handle from Uber's account. So people were just able to reach out to the hacker and they asked him how he did it. What's pretty interesting is that from what the rumors are, it sounds like they got access to usernames and passwords. So as of right now, it's not clear how they did this. Some forums are saying they might have purchased it from some online dark websites where they sell stolen credentials or private harvests. Regardless, it doesn't really make a difference because Uber had multi-factor authentication enabled. And this means that even with the employee's username and password, they couldn't log in because the employee had to approve the login. Now, whenever they attempted to log in, it would send a push notification to the employee's phone. And they would be asked whether they want to approve or decline the login. And they basically just kept logging in, hoping that the employee would accidentally approve. But they never did. This is where it gets cool. The attacker actually moved to contacting the employee on WhatsApp, claiming to be from Uber's, of course, IT team. And basically, they just asked them to manually approve the login, and they did. Now, this is textbook social engineering attack, and it happens all the time. These organizations can have hundreds, thousands, even, you know, tens of thousands of employees. And the chance that someone actually gives their credentials and multi-factor authentication is a given. But it shouldn't be the end of the line. What happened next, though, is where it gets really bad for Uber. See, although the scanner was 18 and although the hacker was young, he was well-versed in scanning networks for some specific files. And he happened to have come across, in a very short window, a PowerShell script. And this PowerShell script had the admin credentials for the PAM account. Now, for those of you that don't know, the PAM is basically responsible for managing and securing most of the privacy, most of the accounts on the network. So once you've got, that's right. Once you've got access to that, it's game over. So they had access to the company's Google Cloud, their AWS, their expenses, their dashboard, even their antivirus. They were basically able to compromise everything on the network in one swoop. Now, the real mistake is not the social engineering, because this happens all the time. It's the fact that they had a hard-coded admin credentials in a PowerShell script that was publicly accessible and shared. This is where companies make oopses sometimes.
If I may chime in, Christos, I'm sorry to jump in, and it begs a question, right? As a lot of companies have a cloud-first strategy, let's go to the cloud, Azure, AWS, GCP, sometimes they go very quickly leveraging their sysadmins and instantiate all their core and critical applications in the cloud. How do they manage who has access to those credentials and accounts? Because if you have access, you could wipe everything out. If you're a disgruntled employee, if you're leaving the business, even if you're in good terms with your employer, run after your passwords and credentials. So, you know, that's an additional attack surface. So how does that relate to this situation? How could companies improve their posture with all those cloud admins that control all the assets in the hyperscalers?
I'll come back to that question as soon as I'm done explaining, unless somebody else has an answer. Bill, I see you want to chime in.
No, I'm good for now. I'll let you keep rolling.
Okay. That's a very good question, Patrick. And I will bring a point to that, but you have to understand One thing that's important with cybersecurity is to always start small. Start with a test group, implement the full functioning of the security tactic that you're trying to implement, and then reverse onboard the original members of the company, starting with executives all the way down to the janitors. And unfortunately, companies still can't execute this simple task. So I've seen projects start, I just never see them finish. So now, of course, it's not clear why this was the case or how that document got there. Nobody knows who put it there yet. Okay, I'm sure we're going to find out down the line when the full incident report has been completed. But what we do know is that a single 18-year-old was able to go from social engineering an employee who basically a full network compromise in a very small amount of time. And coincidentally, this is all happening in the midst of the trial of Uber's ex-security chief that got indicted on federal charges for attempting to cover up a breach in 2016. So in 2016, what happened is they stole a bunch of user data, including stuff like addresses and credit cards. And they basically reached out to Uber and said, hey, if you give us money, we'll delete the data. And Uber complied. They paid $100,000 to the hacker. Imagine doing an hour of work and getting $100,000. That's not bad. And basically told them to go away. And they never said anything about the breach. But investigators found out that the CISO ended up actually getting charged, and he's in court as we're having this discussion, right? Now, I don't work for Uber. I don't claim to be an expert on the Uber breach, but I have seen a lot of breaches that look very similar to this. Organizations often focus a lot of energy in not getting their employees hacked, not getting their devices infected with malware, which is great. But it's not the full picture, because ultimately an employee is probably going to get hacked at some point, or they're going to go rogue, or something similar is going to happen, and the hacker is going to end up inside your network. And that's not to say don't secure those devices. Don't try to stop that from happening. Of course, you want to make it as hard as possible, but it's also important to think about, okay, what happens if the hacker does get into the network? Because that shouldn't be game over for the employee. Being compromised should not lead to your entire network being taken over. But anyways, those are my thoughts. Based on the info that's come out so far, that's what I understood. I'm going to keep doing some digging to see if anything else comes out. And if I learn more, I'll bring it up on the next episode of this.
Perfect.
Okay.
Follow-up question for the panel. Chris, Bill, Patrick, if you're Uber CISO, what's first on your priority list?
Resign.
Jeez.
You know, this seems like such a fundamental thing to say, but... good security awareness training that's based on specific process to follow. If you get a call from a help desk after seeing, you know, dozens or hundreds of authentication attempts, you should probably say, hey, let me call you back, dial your IT support line itself, and then say, I just got a call from you guys asking me to do X. I'm calling to confirm it. Something as simple as that could have avoided the whole scenario. And it seems crazy to say, but you know, humans are always going to be the weakest cog in the chain, and most cybersecurity teams are redlined today. So yeah, it's this fatigue mentality of I have to get to the next task, I have to get to the next task. So we got to slow down a little bit, is what I'd say.
Patrick,
I'd also be curious of looking at the event logs at the SIM, trying to understand. There had been multiple failed attempts and challenged and requests that had not been replied to. That should be a metric that was looked at, trying to understand why did those go potentially uninvestigated. I'm not saying that they were or weren't. I don't know. But I'd say looking at your metrics as well, what are you getting for your SIM data, and doing some type of correlation and focusing on your sources of data within the organization for investigations.
And absolutely.
How complex the issue is, because I'm going to answer something different from all the others, and it's a layered approach. You mentioned the weakest link. Well, that's why And I know it's overused, but zero trust architecture is critical. You need to plan and design for cases where the hackers are going to come into your network. So eliminate lateral movements, network segmentation, virtual firewalls, and all sorts of different mechanisms to capture or limit the damages that the perpetrator will do. So zero trust combined with not anything we've thought. You can't do just one of the things we talked about today. It has to be a layered approach.
Agreed.
Did you know that Navalogic became a virtual guardian company in 2022? Based in St. Paul, Minnesota, Navalogic's dedicated team of experienced, certified professionals provide deep knowledge and expertise in cybersecurity and risk management to organizations looking to gain confidence and demonstrate resilience in their cybersecurity auditing and compliance processes. Learn more at navalogic.com.
And there's some options there out there in the for people who are looking for solutions for that MFA fatigue attack where Christos mentioned it. You know, when the hacker has the credentials and is trying to log on and the legitimate employee is getting those requests, approve or deny, and then they deny. At one point, sometime they get fed up and they say approve, just so it stops. They see it, think it's a problem. But products out there are offering secure verifications with a six-digit number, for example, that you have to enter, and that'll take care of that. So solutions do exist out there, I think. But that social engineering is really hard to guard against. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We have to move on to the second topic, which is we're flying out to California. So let's go to California. And we're in California, but it's a French cosmetic company called Sephora. You may have heard of it. Pretty big, found in pretty much every mall in North America. Well, Sephora has been fined under the CCPA, the California Customer Privacy Act. Bill, I Googled Sephora because I knew of the name. I don't use their products, but I saw that these guys were huge, 30,000 employees, including 15,000 only in North America. They've been ordered to pay a sizable penalty. Why?
Well, I'll just start by saying I know the product line well. Again, not for personal use, but with three daughters and my wife, it's a store that's well known in our household. So, but you are correct. Yeah, CCPA fines Sephora. They're actually the first organization to be fined by the California Consumer Privacy Act for multiple data issues, as well as general misses on their website. So they failed to disclose that they actually sell customer data. Was one of the items. They engaged in unlawful sale of personal information, as well as exchanging that information with third parties. They did not have a do not sell my personal information link on their website or an option to opt out, which, again, I think it comes down to one of those things where we're all trained to click accept all on cookies. I think it's a good lesson to say we need to make sure that we actually understand what we're agreeing to when we accept all on cookies. But that wasn't an option for folks to be excluded from exchanging personal information on the Sephora website. So the result was a $1.2 million fine for Sephora, as well as two additional years of monitoring. So they're going to be continuously evaluated by the CCPA. They have now additional reporting requirements, and they also have to review all their third-party contracts there for the next couple of years. So it's a lot more than the $1.2 million. It's a good chunk of change, but it now comes down to the overall additional scrutiny that Sephora as an organization now has to plan for. So that in itself is pretty big. The other thing I'll point out is it could have been avoided. So Sephora, along with multiple other organizations, they're not named, but they were all notified, or a group of organizations were notified. I believe the date was June 25th. Yep, that's correct. That there were violations that the CCPA believed may have existed in these organizations, and they had 30 days to come within compliance. Sephora did not cure the issues that were found on the websites. And the way that they were actually found is actually through standard browser tools. So it's not like the CCPA is doing anything highly unique or difficult. They're just using standard browser tools and plugins that we could use ourselves to check compliance. But they didn't address any of those particular issues within the 30-day period. And that's what resulted in these fines.
I'm getting some GDPR vibes. I'm getting some privacy vibes. I'm getting those types of issues. Patrick, here in Quebec, where we are in the province of Quebec, do you make any parallels with our own privacy law there, Law 25, that just...
Which is starting today, actually tomorrow, for September 22nd. There's a lot of parts of that law that come into force.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's inspired by GDPR. The California laws are the strictest in the U.S. It's also inspired by them. And we will also, in Canada as a whole, we will be inspired by the Bill 25 here in Quebec. The thing is that we often forget that there's a distinction between cybersecurity and privacy, right? Now, cybersecurity will help enforce privacy, but it is still a different subject. And what's interesting here is the fact that a company was penalized for privacy issues, because all we hear about, especially coming out of California, is data breaches, data leaks, and people being fined, companies being fined. In this case, it was about privacy, which is good and innovative, especially coming in the US, because we know that privacy laws are under challenge, maybe less in California. So Quebec is going to be the same thing. This is an example, because it's not just about cybersecurity, it's about privacy. And if I'm hearing what Bill said correctly, and we read notes on this, the articles invoked for Sephora are the same that are present in Bill 25 out here. And there are financial penalties up to 4% of revenue that could be assessed. So as you look at legislation around cybersecurity, it's becoming a North American thing. So there's going to be, in a future cause, although we have a different criminal code and different rules here, there's an inspiration in terms of arguments that will come from there as well. So organizations need to be ready and need to think, just add privacy to their realm of thinking and not just cybersecurity.
I also think that one of the thoughts that came to me while I was reading the articles, there were multiple, it's not just what you do with the data that you collect. It's for your own use. It's how you sell or transfer or exchange that information, whether it's for analytics, which is some of this information was used for analytic purposes. But how you use that information, even if it's just to make your own website better, if you're using third parties, that data can come into play. So you really have to look at your policies, make sure you have good policies on your website, make sure you have opt-in practices in place, right to be forgotten capabilities for the consumer, and so on. So it's pretty interesting. And I agree with you, Patrick, we're going to see a lot more of this. It's not just going to be California or Canada. We're going to see probably something, I hope that covers all of North America. It'd be fantastic if we could all get on one page.
So Bill, you said you have a lot of clients at home of Sephora. That means your name has probably been sold a few times, right? Just the third party.
Well, probably my wife's, to be honest. But yes, my guess is yes.
Maybe go change your credit card just to be safe. Go change your credit card.
Fair enough.
Okay, great. Thanks for that second topic. Really interesting stuff. Let's go to the third topic. And now we're flying out of California and coming to the Northwest. We're coming to where Patrick and, well, most of us, Patrick and I, were in the province of Quebec, and Christos as well. And I couldn't not mention it. We only have a few minutes here, but in the past month alone, we've had BRP, Bombardier Recreational Product, which is well-known, National Research Institute, the city of Laval, the third largest city in the province, Bell Technical Solutions, colleges, a whole bunch of companies are in the news. Most all of them, not all of them exactly, but almost all of them ransomware related. And Chris, I'm going to give you just 60 seconds on this one. I just like to ask you, like,
it's colleges, a great segue anyways for Chris right after.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Marco, it's almost Christmas time and people want to buy more expensive gifts this year. I think is the usual motivation around maybe, this time of year.
But yeah. What I want to ask you, Chris, is what's the common denominator? I mean, there's colleges, there's private companies, there's cities. What's the common denominator?
So I'll tell you something in 60 seconds. You can go to YouTube as a 9-year-old and type in how to break into a company. And then you go to GitHub, you download the script by pressing download. Then you run the script by double clicking it. And then it does the work for you and you have the password. This is how Ville de Laval got hacked. It was an LLMNR hack where they just put a sniffer on the network. They unplugged the phone, they plugged the laptop. The sniffer went and did what it always does. And this works almost everywhere, right? And it's not, the threat isn't advanced hackers anymore. The advanced hacking is done years ago. It's just recreating what you're seeing on the tutorial anywhere you want. So somebody got bored, went to YouTube, watched the tutorial, went to work, plugged in, ran the script, walked out with 600 gigabytes of data. Good job.
CV, that's actually a marketing campaign right there. So do add promotions of Halcyon with those search keyword searches.
Yeah, I just said the common denominator is Christos Simotas's children at the end of the day. So
some advanced 9-year-olds from what I just heard.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Don't forget the during Hackfest 2 years ago, the person that broke into the voting machines was an 11-year-old girl. Okay. Let's not undermine the kids. They got a lot of free time and they got a lot of imagination.
It's a unique world for sure. I mean, when you look at it, they're on the face, there is no common denominator, right? You know, in trying to sum this up, the only common denominator across all of those particular components, it is that accessibility via access brokers and these hyper sophisticated user groups now on the threat actor side, it's very easy to do. Right. When you start taking a look at it, the common denominator is they were a target on someone's list. It could be, to Christos's point, that they were a hobby of somebody. They became a target and somebody wanted in. In many cases, what we see is that there are targets ransomware related that essentially have a list based on monetary remuneration. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But at the end of the day, the only common attribute is that they were a target. And today with ransomware, because it is so different from other families of malware, and this is a misnomer I hear all the time, if you're targeted with ransomware based on the two forms of it, the campaign and the weapon, impact is almost inevitable, regardless of your stack. And we'll talk about, you know, why that is. So that would be the common denominator. They were a target on someone's list. And at the end of the day, they move forward with the document.
Is your company digitally resilient? 75% of small businesses have no disaster recovery plan, and backup copies do not guarantee an organization's ability to get back to business. For more than 25 years, ESI Technologies has specialized in IT continuity, reducing financial and operational impacts for our clients. Learn more about digital resilience from ESI's experts at esitechnologies.com.
Well, let's jump right into it then, because that's your topic. That's what we're talking about today. Gentlemen, thank you for our Hot Topic segment. Our panelists, Christos, Bill, Patrick, and even Chris, thank you very much. So we're going to move on to our spotlight talk. Chris is going to tell us a little bit more about ransomware. So as I mentioned before, Chris is Halcyon Senior Vice President of Go-to-Market Strategy. He spent about the last 15 years helping clients build their security programs and is now taking on the hardest challenge in cybersecurity, certainly nowadays, yes, ransomware. So the company Chris helped take to market, Halcyon, is the first dedicated anti-ransomware platform built to harden endpoints against ransomware. Halcyon merges an offensive attacker's mindset with the next generation artificial intelligence, micromodel-based detection and prevention layers to provide a single solution to reducing ransomware's impact. So Chris's talk today is titled The Truth About Ransomware. Chris, the floor is yours.
Very cool. Well, Marco, I appreciate it. So a few things. I wanted to, instead of making this a commercial, start with kind of the fundamentals of ransomware. and why the fundamentals of ransomware are probably so misunderstood. We chatted about ransomware being dynamically different than other forms of malware. Why is that? If you look at ransomware, it's a fully coded application. It takes into account all the layers of security into a typical enterprise environment. It is not the same ransomware threat that most people know from a decade ago, where they lock up your grandmother's machine and request $10. They are hyper sophisticated now. We'll talk a little bit about why and how. But if you look at ransomware, there's really two phases to it. There's a campaign and there is a weapon, right? If you look at the campaign is meant to blend a lot of different threats to survey and drive reconnaissance on a customer network or system. Once they have that reconnaissance and they've surveyed that particular network, it helps them build something called a persistence model, right? What is a persistence model? That model allows that threat actor that wants to deploy a weapon, which is the second stage, the ability to persist in that environment even after they have infected and been cleaned and infected and been cleaned over and over and over again. We've talked to many clients that have said, hey, we've stopped ransomware attacks right in their tracks. You know, they got 5 machines or 50 machines. And we say, you know, be careful. Because a lot of times what happens during that campaign phase is access brokers that are doing the recon on these systems that then sell it to people that want to do damage or exploit a particular company, they wind up running something called pilot attacks. Those pilot attacks are done with known ransomware that will be caught in that environment because they've surveyed that environment, understand what tools are in place. They run the pilot attack, not because they want to do damage, but because they want to see how the client responds. What tools do they respond with? How quickly do they respond? What are the different processes and procedures by which they do that, right? They build that into their persistence model and then they lay dormant. And when you think of ransomware, the campaign, it is a long dweller, hundreds of days in many cases. So for most people that will ever deal with a ransomware attack, that infection has probably happened over the course of many months, in some cases, many years. So the campaign is critical to that. A lot of people kind of merge these thoughts together. It's important to note that they are different. Now, the weapon, what is the weapon? The weapon is really the mutations of ransomware that are out there in the market. The RAS families that get all the attention, right? Conti, Riot, et cetera. There's about 100 primary ransomware families out there in the wild. What that tells you is that it's not as prolific as malware, right? Ransomware does not proliferate the same way that malware does, where it's a spray and pray type approach. Let me just mow down all of my targets and see what works. Ransomware is much more targeted than that, right? And we've had those discussions with customers before where we heard someone say, you know, hey, if we do get attacked, it'll be a very hyper-sophisticated targeted attack. The reality is most of the ransomware families that are out there, their attacks are hyper-sophisticated these days, right? They have entire business entities that are set up. They have QA programs, bug bounties. They have HR departments to actually qualify and vet a lot of their affiliate networks. These are traditional businesses that are built for nefarious means. When you start taking a look at it, it may not be viewed that way on that side. They may view it as we're the Robin Hood of cybersecurity, right? Trying to steal from the rich and give to the poor. And at the end of the day, regardless of how they view it, it is still an entity that has gravity to it. Because of that, when they target particular companies, that campaign has given them everything that they need, ideal conditions wise, to be able to execute and do significant damage to a company, right? The weapon itself is the thing that encrypts all the files. It's the thing that locks all your systems up. It brings your business operation to a halt. And that's the thing that you'll do anything to get it back up and running, because if the business comes to a halt, you can't make money. And if you can't make money, there's a whole slew of domino effects that ensue after that. So when we start taking a look at it, those are the two notions behind the campaign and the weapon. The weapon itself, guys, when you see it running live on a system, it actually doesn't look bad at all. It looks very benign. You'll see attribution like open files, read files, write files, delete files. You and I do that. If you take a look and go further, it will encrypt files. It will delete files. Standard backup and recovery software does that, right? So the only way to tell that a ransomware event is bad is when it starts to burn through your machine and it's encrypting hundreds, thousands of files very, very quickly and just burning that machine down. At that point, they've typically launched an attack and now you're trying to contain a wildfire, which is why it's become such a prolific issue, right? They use this impetus of leverage in order to execute an attack. So that was the first thing, the two phases of an attack in particular. The other component is ransomware is hyper-conditional. What do I mean by that? The conditions by which ransomware operates under are like a fully coded application. In these particular conditions, I am going to execute and do X. Under these conditions, I am not going to execute and do X. Some examples of that. Ransomware looks for an ideal state by which to execute that weapon. So they will look for things like elevated privileges, proliferated access. Do I have access to things like domain controllers? Do I have access to Active Directory and I can submit a GPO attack? You start seeing these things that essentially give ransomware the benefit of pulling those levers and creating this heavily leveraged environment, right? And then what you wind up seeing is that those conditions, when they're not present, ransomware does nothing. It sits back and it surveys. It's very silent. It may sit there for long periods of time. In non-ideal conditions, you'll see a sample of ransomware terminate itself, right? What are some examples of non-ideal conditions? I'm running in an analyst machine. There is a debugger running. A disassembler is on this machine. Well, why would ransomware terminate? It doesn't want anybody to know what it is or what it's about to do. And anything that could find it out, it wants to hide itself from. So it terminates itself and it vacates the system. Some other things that it vacates on. I'm running on a home country language system, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. I may be taking a look at any number of different countries of origin that I will vacate against. Ransomware also shows some unique behavior where they start to test their parameters, like a SQL server is present on this machine. Let me actually open up and scan for a database. When you see some of these things in general, scanning for a database when there's a SQL server isn't necessarily nefarious. But at the end of the day, if you can put things in its way to trip it up and trick it, you can find out that it's nefarious. So in terms of ransomware being hyper-conditional, that's the one thing to note for all clients out there, right? Ransomware is not something that's just going to hit you. It's not something that's going to be sprayed out there into the general public. It's not something that is just going to happen in masses and volumes, even though we read about it every day. What happens is ransomware picks a target. It garners that access via its brokerage affiliates, and it burns down that target. It is hyper-successful at doing that. The only difference between somebody that has an attack and doesn't have an attack is whether you were on that target list or not. And I know that's crazy to say, but in studying the threat over a long period of time, it has come to fruition that if somebody wants into that system, garnering access is not nearly as difficult as it may seem. We just talked about an example where access was garnered off of basic social engineering. There are incredibly sophisticated affiliate networks out there that give this access brokerage to these ransomware operators that they then sell to any number of threat actors. Could be state-sponsored governments, could be private entities, it could be hacktivists, it could be any of the above, right? And then what they do is they sell those threats and they get a percentage of whatever those ransom remuneration payments are. And by and large, most people still pay them. The challenge is, how do you not when your business can't operate? Most people also talk about things like exfiltration, right? And that exfiltration ransomware is moving that way. exfiltration happens every day. It has for a long, long time. When we start taking a look at ransomware, not all forms of ransomware do it. As a matter of fact, still a minority forms of ransomware do exfil. The only reason they do exfil is to extort you if you refuse to pay a particular ransom. And at that point, you will see those techniques move and migrate over time. So when we start taking a look at it, there's a few things that I wanted to outline. What do clients do to protect themselves? We talked a little bit about each one of these, strong security awareness training, good layered security controls, and a solid disaster recovery and business continuity plan. What are the challenges to those things? Two, humans. We talked about it earlier. We're the weakest link, right? And then two, legacy tech debt. If you are a business that has an application or any technology that's running in your environment, running critical or core systems that has been in place for decades, and it's very hard or difficult to take that out, the challenge with that is every time you put a layered security control in, you have to open up holes to make it work because that particular application may break those controls or those controls may break that application. So now you whitelist them. And every time you whitelist something, a hole opens up. It's impossible not to in most environments today. But those are the two limiters for most companies, humans and legacy tech debt. If you go a step further, what are some of the control gaps? Things like EDR were the biggest advancement on the endpoint, right? The challenge is the architecture of EDR, the application drivers that make it susceptible to bypasses and evasions in any 24-hour period, because EDRs have to do so much, everybody expects them to be perfect. And that's an unfair expectation. They always have samples that get by. It's not the EDR's fault. They're doing their job and they're doing an incredible job of it. The challenge is the volume of the attacks that come through generically. Ransomware can masquerade and hide behind them and slip right in. When you also start taking a look at things like backup and recovery software, it's become a standard. It's a de facto now. Here's the challenge with many backup programs as part of that DR scenario. Nobody tests recovery at scale, at least very few. I haven't come across any yet. Doesn't mean they don't exist. And there's really four issues. As part of that campaign, ransomware corrupts your virtual shadow copies and your backups first. Secondarily, they take a look at if you have to backup from a particular backup copy, you lose all that work. They know that's a point of leverage. They also know if you have to backup, even if it's immutable and air-gapped, you actually have to backup over the network. It creates a logistics problem, so it's not quick. Typically 7 to 21 days on average. And then finally, even if you back up that infrastructure because of that persistence model I talked about, they just reinfect you because you built the same infrastructure that was just infected. So based on what clients do, there are some particular limiters, humans and legacy tech debt, that lead to some control gaps that aren't the controls issue themselves, but it's a combination of different facets. And ransomware operates based on those in-between spaces, right? And it's unique. So when you start taking a look at that, the last component that I'll talk about, because I know that we are running short on time and I want to leave it open for questions, is the business of ransomware, right? Why is this threat here to stay long-term? Most people talk about, hey, if Bitcoin goes to zero, no more ransomware, right? The challenge with that is it's a significant criminal economy now, right? And based on that criminal economy, there will always be ways outside of things like Bitcoin that payment will be able to be collected. The impact in the economy that ransomware has created, bar none, is the biggest in the malware space. And there's only 100 primary families that create them. Think about that. Now, most of them were Russian. Now you're starting to see the Chinese and North Koreans, Venezuelans and Iranians come out with their own variants and strains of ransomware. There's many other across the globe. What happens when 100 grow to 1,000 or 10,000? The problem that we have now has dominoed out of control. When you also look at the business of ransomware, I'm going to give you some financial statistics. We have a slide that we show a lot of clients. And it shows two company profiles. both have about $200 million in annual recurring revenue. One has 3,000 employees, one has 30. One has a negative 106% profit, meaning they operate at a loss. And one has a 96% profit, meaning it's the most hyper-profitable business on the planet. And we ask a silly question. It's rhetorical, but we ask it anyway. What business would you rather invest in? And everybody picks the more profitable business. And we unblur it, and it's the Conti ransomware family. You'd be a great investor in a ransomware family. And they say, what's the other one? And we flash it up, and it's Sentinel One, one of the best DDRs on the market. It shows you comparatively the threat and the financial gain that is in this, and what an advantage some of these threat actors have over us. Ransomware is the most profitable business on the planet. If you look at cybercrime, it has overtaken drugs in general as being the biggest underground economy in the world. And because of that, it is not going away. So I wanted to start with the basics, start to outline what people think in some of the misconceptions around ransomware. Take a look at what do clients do and where are some of the holes in that. And then finally talk about the threat from the perspective of it's here today and it's here to stay, right? It will not go away. So with that, I'll actually turn it back over, guys, and try to keep us on time.
You're behind the shield. If you're enjoying today's live episode, listen to Encore Performances. Search for our podcast, Virtual Guardians Behind the Shield, at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We want to arm your business with the knowledge to navigate today's threat landscape. Remember, when you're behind the shield, you're ahead of the game.
Wow, that was great. And that's a nice little trick you pull there at the end with the Conti investment. Very nice. Well done.
If you want, we can get you in, Marco.
Yeah. I think I'll pass. I'll talk to my financial advisor. That was really, really good, Chris. Thank you very much. And one thing that you said at the end. So, you know, I'm looking at Halcyon and your anti-ransomware company. And there's a phrase at the end that you said that in terms of the business of ransomware, it's here to stay. And my first question to you is it here to stay? Or do you think we can hopefully see maybe a light at the end of the tunnel and one day ransomware will be behind us?
It's why we created the company.
Right.
I feel like we will change the way that the entire cybersecurity segment interacts with endpoint protection and how they view prevention and resilience or recovery and how we meld them together so that even if you were to go down, it's minutes and you can be recovered. We're hopeful that companies like us, you know, will come out and we will help quell some of the pain that is being associated. But like anything, attacks will advance. You know, they will find ways to do unique things. And at the end of the day, it becomes a cat and mouse, no matter how you look at this. It's our mission to be a bigger cat, I guess. And so will we see a light at the end of the tunnel? I think we can see an ease of the burden. I also think that ease of the burden and the innovation you'll see from companies like maybe ours and others will spur innovation on their side as well.
Chris, we can't let you leave before telling us in a couple of key points. What differentiates you guys and how do you guys help customers defend?
Yeah. So if you think about what we do, think of it in really three use cases. Today, all the limiters that I outlined in the control gaps, we protect your current endpoint infrastructure, whether it's an EPP, EDR, XDR, in any 24-hour pass with regards to known threats that we'll get through. We protect those same endpoint infrastructures against bypasses and evasions because we are not architected in the same way with those application drivers that make them susceptible to them, right? So we watch their back, and anytime we see a bypass or evasion technique, we kill it, we can repost them so that your infrastructure stays intact. And then finally, this is the big one. If you look at the average uptime or rather downtime in an attack, 7 to 21 days, tell your CEO you'll be down for 1 to 3 weeks. and see what his response is. We actually reduced that to minutes based on some unique key capture and automated decryption technology and some additional self-healing componentry that we've patented that come out. So at the end of the day, in the event of a successful attack, if one were to occur based on us hardening that platform, we can recover in minutes. And that operational outage essentially is limited. Your business can continue to operate, never pay a ransom, and at the end of the day, continue on.
I have some questions from the audience here. The first one is, well, I guess he doesn't say Chris, but he says, so you don't believe ransomware can be mitigated solely in the IAM space? So that's kind of a statement slash question there. So can ransomware be mitigated with IAM, or what are your thoughts on that?
Purely from an identity perspective, is that the notion of the question?
Yeah, it says solely. Yep. So.
Solely, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so purely from an identity perspective, in theory, you could. The issue is in practice, it's impossible. It's a math problem, right? You know, that would, you have to run a perfect identity program. And I've built programs for 15 years, identity specifically, and I've never seen one. Right. And it doesn't mean that it's not a noble cause and it shouldn't be done. But if you're asking me the notion between reality and theory, I would tell you in theory, yes. In reality, the answer is 100% no. And I put $5 on that ladder every day.
Okay. Another question here from the audience. Let's say a company is able to recover from a disaster, in brackets, intrusion or ransomware, using a healthy copy of the data. Chris said that if you put in place the same infrastructure, you will be hacked again. So what is the best practice when recovering with a copy?
A couple of things. If those copies are good, they're not poison, because that's a real big issue during ransomware attacks. If they are good, with regards to recovering that infrastructure, you have to go through kind of and re-scheme your network, right, to try to break that persistence. The best practice around that is tough, because that's not a backup component. Backups are really there to take the copies, rebuild the machines. Talk to clients every day that say, I can rebuild the machine in 15 minutes, blow away and boom, it's right back up. The challenge is, can you rebuild 1,000 in 15 minutes or 10,000 in 15 minutes or 100,000? It's a logistics problem. When it comes down to that, there's not a best practice, because you still have an impetus of time. Even if you have to rescheme your entire network, that it's going to take you. So the challenge is, backups are good. Never get rid of them. They will always protect you in the event of a plane crashing into your data center or something bad happening. The challenge is, there are better ways to recover from a cyber incident. And that's where companies like us, not just us, but companies like us are coming out to try to do that in a more elegant way.
Okay. Thank you. Oh. And a third one just came in from the audience. Is it fair to say, based on how MFA has failed in scenarios that were mentioned earlier in the segment, does this make a stronger use case for hardware token solutions like Yubico, YubiKeys? Very specific.
My particular take on it is two-factor is always going to be stable, regardless. Whether it's hardware tokens or software tokens, it doesn't matter. You're just adding another layer to make it that much harder for them to persist in the environment, right? Doesn't mean that they can't. Doesn't mean that they can't beat it. You know, that also being said, I don't necessarily think that one or the other is better. I can't say I have a good opinion. Maybe it's my lack of knowledge. I just know that MFA in general, regardless of form factor, is good.
Perfect. And one last one here. And this one, I really enjoy this question here, because it's something that I hear from my customers all the time. It's very topical and polarizing. It's about cyber insurance. So like cyber insurance now, companies don't want to insure anymore, or they're hiking premiums like to super high. So how big of a role ransomware has played in these increases in cyber insurance? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, we actually have carried on with many cyber insurers behind the scenes. They were some of our first customers. So a lot of the data that we built our models on is based on actuarial data, what's been seen in the wild, as opposed to like just notional guesses, right? On average, about 70% of the losses a cyber insurer takes on are attributable directly to the threat of ransomware and all of the componentry and costs that come along with it, right? If you think about that, that's staggering. Not my numbers, I'm repeating them, but on average, 70% of a cyber insurer's losses will be from ransomware. One of the reasons that we came out doing what we're doing is because this will cause significant issues across sectors in many ways. Cyber insurance is one of them. We're trying to also ease that burden. So hopefully I answered the question in short form, but if you guys, you know, wanna ask a derivative thereof, I'm happy to go deeper.
Yeah, maybe a follow-up to there. It eases the burden of cyber insurance, but are you seeing pretty good reductions in organizations you work with and their rates to actually get the cyber policy?
So this is kind of specific to our product, and the answer is yes.
Okay.
We do, as part of our testing, what we wind up doing is something called an efficacy test. So think of it like a ransomware readiness test, right? Where we partner with our partners, and we provide a free service to our clients that we invest in. We provide them the results of this. They upload their build to our vaulted lab, and we test against real world scenarios. You can see the hashes, you can see the results. We take a look at decryption times with regards to before and after, and we present a whole ROI calculator based on actuarial cyber insurance data. They take that, give it to their cyber insurer, talk about how they bought down the risk, show them demonstrable proof, and they request their discount. We've seen anywhere from 10 to 30%, depending on the scenario.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. Well, we're coming up on the hour. And that was the questions from the audience. So we're good on that side. So we're nearing the end of our show. Before we sign off, I just want to thank today's Behind the Shield Spotlight sponsor, Halcyon, and you, Chris, Vincent. That was really, really interesting. Your presentation was great. I also want to thank our panelists, Christos Simotas, Patrick Naum, and Bill Strube, for all their usual insights. Thank you very much, guys. And for everybody that was listening in, if you enjoyed what you heard today, we hope that you come back and join us in the next few months. We have other amazing guests. We have already have some commitments from IBM, OVH Cloud. We have VMware. We have Abnormal Security that are coming up in the next few months. I'm very excited to talk to those people. If you've missed any part of today's show, you can always listen to the podcast, which I mentioned is pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts. It'll be online next week. So you can look for that and listen to it in your car or anywhere. And yeah, thank you everybody for joining us today. I hope you found the last 60 minutes pertinent and informative. And remember, when you're behind a shield, you're ahead of the game. See you next month.